Mike, thank you for that introduction. It was kind of short, but... Right. My name is Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober this morning, and that is the most important thing that I can share with you from this podium, that it is by the grace of a loving God and the tender loving care of people like you in rooms like this that I have awakened for the last 11,256 mornings without a hangover. Now, that impresses me a lot more than it impresses you. Now, so you don't spend the next hour trying to figure that out, I'll tell you. My sobriety date is July 26, 1982. And for that, I am daily grateful. It has been over 30 years since I brushed my teeth with Preparation H. It's been over 30 years since I got in a fight with a parking meter. It won. It's been over 30 years since I pulled up to a sidewalk mailbox and ordered a Big Mac and an order of fries. And it's been over 30 years since I drove into the wrong end of a car wash. I don't know what that woman was screaming so about. I was just as surprised to see her. And I could go on and on and on and on with the things that are no longer a part of my life thanks to this fellowship. It's been a wonderful weekend. I want to thank John and Mike for their hosting me and seeing that I've stayed stuffed all weekend. And to Mike... Always good to be back here and to see Mike again. And Mike will be back up here retiring again next year. I could tell you a great version of my story, but I've got a sponsee sitting back here, and Art S., and so his sole purpose in being here is to keep me honest. And I've got a fellow sponsee, Bob B., over here. He and I share a sponsor. And I do, incidentally, have a sponsor. His name is Dick Martin in Bellevue, Nebraska. He has a sponsor whose name is Clancy Emerson. I have an Al-Anon sponsor whose name is Bo Templin. And that's important because I will not have a sponsor who does not have a sponsor. And I'll tell you a little bit about the why of that in just a little while. I am a non-apologetic cheerleader of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this fellowship. Now, when I was growing up in the hills of North Georgia, making a list of all the clubs, organizations, and institutions that I wanted to be a member of, Alcoholics Anonymous was not in the Hot 100. But I can tell you this morning, that you can have every single organization, every honor that I ever received, you leave me Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a happy camper. I love this fellowship. I love everything that it stands for. And it's not an organization to me, and it goes beyond being a fellowship to me. It is a way of life, a way of life that I never, never even dared dream of when I was growing up. I remember the first time in an AA meeting that I heard, I was sitting right next to a man, and he introduced himself and says, "I am Joe, and I am grateful to be an alcoholic." I got up and moved. I knew that man was crazy, and I didn't know what he might be capable of. Today, I understand that. I am grateful to be an alcoholic. Every drink I had, every hangover I had, every bit of trouble I got into was worth it to give me the life that I have today with you people in this fellowship, in this wonderful thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I happen to think it's one of the greatest gifts that God ever gave mankind. I believe with all my heart, in 1935, or if you prefer, when Bill got sober in 1934, that God in his infinite and compassionate wisdom looked down and said, the lowly alcoholic has suffered for long enough. He's been the outcast of mankind for long enough. I've got to give him a way out. And look at what he gave us. He could have said, lock them up like lepers and put them away so they can't contaminate society. He could have said, put them in jail and throw away the key, as many of us were and should have stayed. He could have said, just let them die. Instead, he gave us each other. And he gave us more love and more joy and more happiness than most of us could have ever dreamed of in 100 lifetimes. And I believe he gave us one other thing. I believe that he gave us a one-on-one relationship with him that few people on this earth will ever know. I think we're the luckiest people that walk the face of God's earth today. I'm grateful for the newcomers. God bless them. They are our lifeline, continue to be, and I think always will be. And Bill and Bob knew that from day one. They knew it when they went to see Bill D. In order to continue this, we had to reach out to the newcomers. And I love getting the newcomers involved in our fellowship and involved in this way of life. It did me good to see the young men coming up here and reading how it works this weekend. So what if they stumble a little bit on it? At our last workshop, we had a young man get up, and he did fine reading how it works, till he got down where he said salt through prayer and medication. And we said, that's okay. Keep coming back. Some people say that they think our disease is genetic. Some people say they think that they got it simply by drinking too much. I'm a little bit like one of our previous speakers of the weekend. I don't care how I got it. I got it. And I do believe that I was born an alcoholic. I think from the very first breath I took, the ism was already in place. At the age of 15, I mixed booze into the formula and began my journey into becoming a full-blown drunk and alcoholic. And I say that because I'm one of those that from my very earliest memory, I felt I didn't belong. I felt like an outsider on the outside looking in. I felt like that everybody else seemed to know something that I didn't know, to have something that I didn't have. There was a missing it. And I figured if I could ever find that missing it, that I would fit, that I would belong. And I began a search for almost 40 years of trying to find that missing it. It's a tough search when you don't know what it is you're looking for. But I looked nonetheless. And I say I never fit in and never belonged. Last summer, I went to the 50th anniversary of my high school graduating class. I was sorry that none of my classmates showed up. It's just a bunch of old people there. But you could have asked those people about me and my belonging. They went, my God, Bill Sanders joined everything that came along. I did. Church, school, scouts, you name it, I joined it, but I belonged to nothing. I always felt like an outsider. Scared to death of people. Get in a conversation, a group of people, and I'd spend the whole time staring at my feet. Could not function in society. Now, that said, when I was 13 years old, I went into the profession that was to be my profession for the next 50 years until I retired some years ago, and that's the broadcasting business. I became a disc jockey at a small 1,000-watt daytime radio station at the age of 13. Purportedly then to be the youngest DJ in America. That's long since records been broken. But I became a disc jockey, and everybody assumed that the smart aleck kid spinning rock and roll records, bumping his gums, was who I was. They didn't know that it was that same scared kid hiding behind the anonymity of a microphone, being somebody else. Who? Well, I was to make a career, practically, of being somebody else. The who was whoever you wanted me to be. I became a chameleon. I became the master people pleaser. I would read you. I would decide what your philosophy was. I would hear what your religion is, what your political beliefs are, and I'd match them down the line. And in a given night sitting in a bar, I could change religions 9 times. I also was constantly, during my drinking years, changing professions. There are a lot of people who never knew that I was once an astronaut. And I could go at great lengths explaining to you my career as an FBI agent. But those were only in my mind and only in the lies that I lived. I became such a chameleon, by the time I reached the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no clue who Bill Sanders was. I had completely and totally lost myself. I was an empty vessel, an empty soul, devoid in my spirituality, and living in a constant state of fear and of misery. In a great sense, I'm grateful for that, because I came to AA with one of the greatest gifts that God gave me prior to my arrival at the doors of this fellowship. I was desperate. And I'm grateful for that desperation. Due to that desperation, I have only one white chip, which I'm not sure here, but in Georgia, that is the surrender chip. And I'm grateful that I have only one. And I have only one I owe to two things. One, my desperation, and then the other is good sponsorship. And I'm going to talk more about sponsorship a little bit later on. As I said, I had my first drink at the age of 15. One Saturday night, we lived in a dry county up in North Georgia on the South Carolina line. And one Saturday night, a group of friends said, "You want to go to Carolina with us and buy some beer?" And I said, "Sure." I don't know if it was peer pressure, curiosity, or what. But I went with them, and there was this little beer joint you could pull up behind it and honk the horn. And the guy would come out the back door, and if you could see over the steering wheel, he'd sell it to you. And we bought what I'm pretty sure I remember was a case of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. And went back and sat on the old muddy banks of the Savannah River. They say you ought to go back to where you had your first beer or your first drink. And I can't do that today because where I had my first drink is now about 300 feet at the bottom of a Corps of Engineers lake, Lake Hartwell. But someone took out a church key and popped open that beer and handed it to me. Now, some of you are too young to know about church keys. I assure you it had nothing to do with opening the doors of a church. But he handed me that beer, and I took a great big slug of it. And I can tell you this morning, as clearly as it was that many years ago, it was the most vile, putrid, god-awful tasting stuff I had ever put in my mouth. Gagged on it. Probably why I only drank 6 that night. Get a dry mouth just thinking about it. I don't need to elaborate to you guys the little phenomenon that happened somewhere between the second and the third beer. You know what happened. In that moment, I suddenly became smarter and wiser and wittier and taller and sexier than I had ever been in my entire life, or for that matter, anybody I'd ever known in my entire life. And in that moment, I thought, "Bill, you found a friend. You found it. It's in that bottle or in that can. That's going to be my friend for the rest of my life." And it almost was. That best friend remained my best friend for many years until it became my worst enemy. And you know, I don't know the day and time when that change took place. Because you see, I have a disease. A disease that does things to me that I don't know about. I've yet to run into an alcoholic who can tell me the date and time and place when they crossed over that line. When they drank because they enjoyed it until they drank because they had to. I don't know of anybody that knows the date when that happened, and I certainly am not the first. That night, a belief was set in place that I was to carry with me for over a quarter of a century. And that belief was that alcohol affected everyone who drank the same way it affected me. I know today, and I've learned in this fellowship, it doesn't. Drinking alcohol does not change everyone's perception of reality. It doesn't change their personality into something less than desirable. To now that I know that, it explains things that I have never understood and never will understand. For example, I've never understood the person that says, no more for me, one's my limit. You ever wanted one of anything? But the one that really gets me, still does to this day, and I'll die not understanding the person who says this. No more for me. I'm beginning to feel it. That's just dumb. I want to say to him, that ain't where you quit. That's where you get going good. Don't understand those people. Never did, never will. And what's more, I know they never understood me. They never did, and they never will. And I became convinced during the latter years of my drinking that no one would ever understand me. Because my disease started teaching me that I was different, but not in a great good way. That I still didn't belong in a bad, bad way. I didn't drink that much in high school because I grew up in a small town. And if any of you who grew up in small towns know, there's one thing they're very short on in small towns, and that's anonymity. Everybody knows everybody else's business. And if my little Southern Baptist mother had ever caught me drinking, I would not have needed AA. I would have needed an undertaker. But then I went off to college, and I became, I went to a University of Georgia, and the student population was over three times the population of my whole hometown. And I had my first taste of anonymity. Nobody cared how much I drank. Nobody cared whether I went to class or not. And I began my journey into the depths of alcoholism, but I didn't know it, because you see, my disease kept me from realizing that. I'd like to share with you some fond memories of my college career. I really would love to. By then, I was beginning to suffer from what people in the hills of North Georgia refer to as spells. We have another word for them. We call them blackouts. 1961, that was a blackout. Needless to say, I spent 4 years in Athens, Georgia, constantly in trouble with the dean of men, constantly being threatened with being thrown out of school. And I won't even begin to go into to some of that. Some of it was horrific. Some of it was just plain stupid. One Saturday night, though, I will share one story. My roommate and I were visiting in an apartment of another friend in college there. And in his apartment, he had on the wall an antique gun collection that he was very proud of. And he had it insured for a ton of money, and it was just something he was very proud of. At about 2 o'clock in the morning, we'd been drinking since sundown, and I had reached that blithering idiot stage of my drinking, and I reached up on the wall and grabbed an old long barrel Colt 22 pistol and started waving it around like Matt Dillon or Wyatt Earp, pointed at my roommate and said, "Stick 'em up," and he threw up his hands, and I squeezed the trigger, and there was a sound like thunder, and in an instant, my roommate was lying on the floor in front of me in a pool of blood. They were to tell us some hours later at a hospital in Athens, Georgia, that my roommate would live, but that he would never walk again. The bullet had severed his spine. The next morning in that hospital room, a very strange thing happened. My roommate reached up from the hospital bed and put his hand on my arm and said, "Bill, for God's sake, don't blame yourself. This was an accident. It could just as easily have been the other way around. Don't blame yourself, please." He had forgiven me immediately, but I didn't forgive myself for more than 20 years because I didn't know how. It was not until you people gave me the magic and the power of the fourth, the fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth steps that I was able to find forgiveness and to find peace and to find surrender. Instead, I did the only thing I knew to do, and that was to crawl deeper into the bottle. And I did it with a vengeance. And I drank until there was not enough booze to make the voices go away and the anger and the self-loathing. And I decided to end it all, so I went to the college infirmary and over a period of weeks amassed a supply of sleeping pills. And I waited until one Friday afternoon when my new roommate was headed home for the weekend. He bought a brand new car and wanted to show it off to his family. And I watched as he pulled out of the dormitory parking lot. And I closed the drapes and sat down on the side of the bed and emptied what was later determined to be somewhere between 50 and 60 sleeping pills. And one by one and two by two, I swallowed them down, pulled up the covers, and turned out the lights. For over 20 years, I thought it was a huge coincidence. I love that word. I thought it was a huge coincidence that my roommate's brand new car, conked out at the city limits of Athens, had to be towed back to the dealership, and he walked back into that dormitory room, found me, knew the frame of mind I'd been in, saw all the little bottles, and called an ambulance. I love that word coincidence, especially the definition that I heard in these rooms, that a coincidence is a miracle in which God chooses to remain anonymous. And I believe that was the first of many times that the God you men introduced me to looked down and said, "Big boy, I'm not through with you yet." When I think of all the insane behavior, the crazy places that I found myself through the years, the wrecked cars, the jail cells, I know tonight or this morning that someone had to have been watching over me. Needless to say, I was taken to the hospital and my stomach pumped out, and it was decided then that I was in serious need of some help. Now, there are two different words that we could use here. Help, excuse me, help, H-E-L-P, means that you require some assistance. But if you're in need of help, H-E-P, that means you're in deep doo-doo. And I needed help. So I began my journey through the world of counseling and psychiatry. Over the next 20 years, I have no idea how many of those individuals I went to see. Psychiatrists, psychologists, psychological social workers, counselors, you name it, and I went to see every one of them. Walked out of their offices damning them because not one single one ever did one single thing to help or help me. Now, we got this little old thing that we talk about around this fellowship called rigorous honesty. And that little deal forces me to admit to you that there is a remote possibility one or more of them might have been able to help me if I had ever once told them the truth. Somewhere around the third or fourth question, "Mr. Sanders, you think you might have a drinking problem?" "No, no, I drink fine." And they go off treating something else. One of them, a very famous shrink that I went to see over a period of a couple of years. This shrink and his partner had had a patient of some notoriety. They were treating a woman who had three distinct personalities living inside her body. And they had written a book about this woman that they were treating. And then after the book was written, a movie came out. And about the time I was seeing this doctor was when that movie was coming out. And it was called The Three Faces of Eve. And this woman had three personalities living in her body. It became world famous. It won Best Picture that year. Joanne Woodward got Best Actress. And I kept asking my doctor all the questions I could about this woman and those three personalities that she had in her body. And of course, he wouldn't tell me very much at all because of the patient-doctor confidentiality. But I wanted to know all I could. And the reason I wanted to know all I could is because I thought if I could get my personalities down to just three, that I might be able to deal with it. But you see, I have these conventions that go on up here in my head. And they gather and they meet and they argue and they discuss and they decide where I ought to go and who I ought to see and whether or not I ought to drink. And I wish I could say when I got sober that they went away, but they didn't. They're still there. And I've got to tell you something this morning, fellas, that it pains me to have to tell you this. But because of honesty, I've got to tell you. They don't like you. They don't like it when I'm hanging out with you. They just assume that I stay away from you as far as they can get me. But I'm thankful because I like me better when I'm with you. You bring out the best in this old drunk. But my disease wants me to get away from these meetings. And I was sharing with somebody just the other night. The few times in the last 30 years that I have drifted a little bit in my recovery, I came across a reality. And it's at the heart of my disease. And that reality is that every meeting I miss makes missing the next one just a little bit easier. And it doesn't take long for that voice in the back of my head to wake up and say, see, you don't need that many meetings. You don't need to go set so many meetings. You can cut back on it. And you don't need to have to talk to that sponsor that often. In that book, do you even know where it is? Oh, don't worry about where it is. It's safe somewhere. That's my disease, and that's that meeting going on back there. And that's why today I go to a lot of meetings. Somebody asked me recently, do you really need to go to that many meetings? And I said, I have no idea. I don't know which meetings I go to because I need to, and which meetings I go to because that's where I'd rather be than any place else I know. I think mostly the latter is true, but I'm not going to try to figure it out because I don't care. As I said, I spent 50 years in broadcasting. I had a lot of wonderful experiences. I met a lot of wonderful and illustrious people. Met a lot of jackasses and jerks. And people in show business can be like that, but there are a lot of wonderful people there too. Because I'm in Texas, I will share one experience with you. Some of you have heard this story before, but you're going to hear it again. One Saturday afternoon, I'm in the newsroom at WSB in Atlanta. The news director comes in and says, Bill, grab a tape recorder, go downtown. You got to go do an interview. Okay, who am I interviewing? He said, you're going to interview Lyndon Johnson. Okay, well, I got the tape recorder and jumped into the mobile unit and started downtown. I said, you know what, Bill? You're going to need a little fortification before you go do that interview. So I stopped at one of the neighborhood bars and I had a couple of quick shots. Got back in the car, went down to a hotel in downtown Atlanta. Got on the elevator, went up to the designated floor, met at the door by the elevator door by the Secret Service, and they frisked me, checked over my gear and my credentials, ushered me into the parlor of this hotel suite. This giant of a man grabbed me by the hand and said, come on in, boy, and have a seat. And I walked in, and I sat down on a sofa, and I noticed he sat down on a sofa that was facing me, and between us there was a coffee table. And on that coffee table, there were a couple of glasses and a jug of Jack Daniels. He said, before we do this thing here, let's have us a little snort. Sounded good to me. He poured my glass full, and then he poured his glass full. And I should tell you at this point, back then you didn't just walk in and sit down and start interviewing the president. You had to go through what was known as the pre-interview interview. That's where you tell him what questions you're going to ask. He tells you whether or not he'll answer them. And you kind of sort things out so the interview goes a lot smoother when you get started. So we're talking, and I'm taking a few sips off of that drink. And every time I'd get about three swallows, he'd reach over and fill the glass back up again. A little while, it started getting hot in that room. A few minutes later, it hit me. My God, that man is drunker than you are. A couple of minutes after that, he said, turn that thing on, let's do it. I turned on the tape recorder and we started the interview, and I asked questions, good questions. He gave good answers. The interview went beautifully until I got down to the point where I asked him a question about his wife, Ladybug. Now, Bob, this is where I can always gauge the age of the audience. Because some of these guys are going, her name was Lady Bird, not Lady Bug. Thank God he thought it was funnier than y'all did. I have a lot of fond memories of my years in broadcasting, and some of my sponsees have urged me to write a book, but there are a number of other people out there who would pay me not to. But I still may before I check out. I don't know. In the latter years of my career in broadcasting, I had to do a lot of traveling to cities like, you know, New York and Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Dallas. And for years, I said I was afraid of flying. I have since learned that I never was afraid of flying. I was afraid of crashing is what I was. So I would always get out to the Atlanta International Airport early so I could stop in the bar and have a couple of drinks before I get on the plane. It always worked. Any time I'd get on the plane, I didn't care where they went. The only problem is sometimes I'd forget to get on the plane. Now, for years, our hometown airline, Delta Airlines, had a slogan that ran for about 6 years as an advertising theme. And it's very ironic that I did the voiceover for some of those television commercials. And I only had one line that was the theme line of the whole advertising campaign. And the line that I had in the commercial simply said, Delta is ready when you are. They lied. They'll leave you. So I did what any good drunk could do. I just get on another airplane and go somewhere else. Call home that night. Wife says, how's your meeting in New York? I don't know. I'm not in New York. Where are you? I'm in New Orleans. And more often, I would wake up in strange places, in strange beds with strange people. More and more, my behavior became more and more bizarre. And the disease was in total control of my life. Along this way, a beautiful, beautiful little baby, blue-eyed baby girl was born to my wife and me. And I was going to be the world's greatest father. Excuse me. I was going to cut down on my drinking, and I was going to be a good dad. But my disease had other plans. And by now, I know that my disease outfitted me with something that I didn't know that I had. And it's what I've today called my alcoholic blinders. It only allowed me to see what it wanted me to see. Those blinders didn't allow me to see that the only look that was ever in my little girl's eyes, who by now was 5 or 6 years old, was a look of fear and of hate and of disgust. Those blinders didn't allow me to see that my little girl never invited friends to come spend the night because she never knew when Dad's coming home in the middle of the night in a drunken rage, smashing furniture, throwing televisions through plate glass windows, dragging her out of bed at 3 a.m., belittling her and emotionally abusing her. You know, I said for years I was never abusive to my wife or daughter. What a lie that was. It was only through Al-Anon that I learned the tentacles of my disease that knew no limits. My wife, I claimed to her that I never physically abusive to her. She claims that I was. But I told her if she had not tried to catch that TV I was throwing out the window, her finger would not have gotten broken. That's not my fault. But most of the rest of it was. I was abusive, and I know today that my disease reached out and polluted everybody that I came in contact with, friends, co-workers, employees, everybody. But the blinders didn't allow me to see it back then. I thought I was a classy drinker because I did a lot of entertaining in a lot of fancy places in Atlanta. I had a gigantic expense account, and I used it liberally. I was known in restaurants all over town and known to be a big spender. I used to love to take people into the bar with me where I would walk through the door. The bartender would greet me by name and have my glass sitting in front of my usual stool when I walked in. And I liked to take people to see that because I thought it made a statement. I noted this morning it most assuredly did make a statement, just not the one I thought it was making. I thought I was a classy social drinker. I'm here to tell you now that I know that if you have to drink in order to be social, you are not a social drinker. And I believed that. It's not classy, as I thought I was, when you wake up in the morning and you look down and there's dew all over your clothes and you blink your eyes and realize you're looking out from underneath a bush in a downtown Atlanta City park. You blink again and realize you're looking up the nostrils of a policeman's horse. There is no good answer to the question of what are you doing here. All I can think of is where is here. There's no class when you're pulled out of a car and you've planted into a steel post on the side of an Atlanta City street. And you're cuffed and put in that cage in the back of the cop car. And all the way to the jail, I'm talking to this young rookie cop, telling him he's making the biggest mistake he's ever made in his life. I tell him, there ain't no way in the world I'm drunk. I've only had 2 beers. I can tell you this morning, fellas, I'm convinced that there's a school somewhere that they take us to when we're in a blackout, every one of us. And the only thing they teach at that school is, if you're ever stopped by the cops, never admit to more than 2 beers. Well, think about it. You watch these cop shows on TV. They pull a guy out of the car, and he's staggering around all over the place. And they said, fella, you had too much to drink. And, oh, just 2 beers. My wife and I were watching it some months ago, and they dragged this guy out of the car and propped him up against the car, and he slid down the car and bloomed on the ground. They picked him up and propped him up again, and right back down he went. And he looked down and said, Pops, you had a little too much to drink? He said, no, I have 3 beers. And I went, oh, hell, he missed class. But I'm telling this cop there ain't no way I'm drunk. He took me and he put me on that breathalyzer doohickey, and I blew on it. It registered 0.28. And I said, that's impossible. There ain't no way I could be registering 0.28 on two beers. Cop agreed with me. I can assure you it's the only thing we agreed on. I'm also here to tell you, in case you've never done it, it is not smart to go to court for a DUI drunk. In case you've never done it, judges don't like it. That was my first one. I had a friend who was a lawyer. He said, Bill, don't sweat it. Don't worry about it. When you get in there and they call your name and ask how do you plead, you simply stand up and say, Your Honor, I plead nolo contendere. I said, what does that mean? That means you plead no contest. He'll slap you on the wrist, give you a little fine, send you on your way, and everything will be cool. Don't worry about it. Okay. Court day comes. Need a little fortification. So I had a few drinks at home and a few drinks in the car on the way down to court. And I walked in, sat down in that courtroom, and they read names and read names and read names and read names, seemed like forever. It got hot as hell in that courtroom. Finally, they called my name. Mr. William Sanders, how do you plead? I stood up and I said, Your Honor, I plead Nimlun Neeler newly re guilty. I couldn't remember that damn Latin to save my life. My marriage fell apart, degree by degree, because my wife drank and had her own misbehavior. I drank. I broke every vow that I had made. So many nights, my wife would be off drinking somewhere, and I would be off drinking somewhere. A beautiful little girl who by now is 11, 12 years old is home alone in an apartment in a big city. At times on the phones calling bars, is my dad there, is my mom there? The phone would ring, the bartender would answer and say, it's your kid. Voice on the end of the line trembling, Daddy, please come home, I'm scared. Where's your mom? I don't know, Daddy, please come home. And the answer was always the same. I will, sweetheart. I'll be home just as soon as I have one more drink. And you know the rest of that story. Hours later, many drinks later, I would stumble into that apartment. And there, cowering in the corner of the bed, tears streaming down her face, was that beautiful little girl. But the blinders were firmly in place. When I was changing the mattress on her bed, one time I picked it up and underneath was her diary, and I did what I shouldn't have done. I opened it and I read. And the words jumped off the page, I wish my daddy was dead and maybe there'd be some peace in our home. But my disease didn't care. And by now it was no longer my best friend, it was my worst enemy. It had turned on me, where and when, I do not know. My wife and I barely spoke. More nights than not, I was not even at home, and she cared not. One night, I'm sitting in my recliner chair late in the afternoon, bottle in my hand, staring at the TV. My wife goes out the door, and I didn't ask where she's going, didn't care. She's gone for 2 or 3 hours, and she comes back in and walks in and stands in front of me. I'm still sitting in that recliner chair, nursing my bottle, staring at that television, probably trying to decide whether to turn it on or not. And she said, guess where I've been? And I said, who gives a, who cares? And she didn't say anything. She did something really weird. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. And I looked down at it, and I looked back at her, and I looked back at it. And then I said, I don't know where you've been, but if that's all you won, you had a lousy night. Well, some of y'all probably figured out where she'd been. She'd been to an A&A meeting. And she told me that, and I went into an absolute flying, pluperfect rage. Because I knew beyond any shadow of a doubt, there was no way on earth that that woman was an alcoholic. No way. Because if she was an alcoholic, then she just couldn't be an alcoholic. That's just... But you know what? She didn't care what I thought. She just started going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings. Some fool nonsense about 90, 90, and 90-something. And I'm waiting for the other shoe to fall. I'm waiting for her to say, you need this more than I do. You're a bigger drunk than I am. Not a word. There were a few little clues left around the house. Like I'd go in the bathroom and lift the toilet seat, and there's how it works, taped to the lid. She knew where I'd see it. Finally, the other shoe fell. She said, I'm going tonight to pick up a 90-day medallion, and I'd like you to be there. No, no way, not going to happen, not in this life. Forget it. A few tears, a few deals, and I said, okay, I'll go with you, but for one condition, I'm going in my car. I said, where are we going? She said, we're going to a place called the 8111 Club. And I said, where's that? She said, just follow me. And I got behind her, and I drove a few miles from our house, and she turned in the driveway of this little house sitting up on the hill in a grove of trees. Pretty little house. Felt funny when I drove up that driveway, because I had passed that house 100 times on the way home from the bar. And I'd look up there and say, Bill, I'd look at all those cars and say, Bill, you ought to get to go know the guy that lives there, because he obviously has a party every night. Well, that night, old Bill went to the party. I slipped in back of the room behind a post, and for the next hour, I witnessed the biggest bunch of weirdos I'd ever seen in my life. They read all that stuff at the beginning, and then they get through, and this one guy is waving his arm like this, and I'm saying, God's sake, somebody tell that man where the bathroom is. They pointed to him. He stood up and right out loud told him his name and said that he was an alcoholic. And I'm thinking, you know what? I don't think I'd have told that if I'd have been him. Then he told them that he had gotten 3 DUIs. And you know what that bunch of people did? They busted out laughing. I don't ever want to forget the thought that went through my mind at that moment. The thought that went through my mind was, why are these people laughing? Don't they know what they are? They're alcoholics. They've got nothing to laugh about. I don't ever want to forget that. Because I can tell you this morning, I thank God every day of my life for the laughter that we share in these rooms. Because there is magic and there is power and there is healing in that laughter. And wherever I go, I tell people, if you don't have a home group that laughs a lot, go find one that does. I also like to caution newcomers, don't laugh all the time or they'll come get you. Next guy got up and said he'd had 6 DUIs and was arrested for indecent exposure. That crowd came unglued. I thought, my God, if they knew some of the stuff that happened to me, I'd sound like Richard Pryor. Meeting went on, seemed like forever, and finally they got up and said the Lord's Prayer, the only thing I recognized that whole hour. And I struck out across the parking lot, made it about halfway to my car, and something grabbed me by the shoulder that felt like a steel vise, spun me around, and I found myself looking up into the face of a man 7 feet 11 inches tall. I can tell you this morning he was only 6'4", but he seemed a lot taller that night. I remembered him from the meeting. He was a little different from the rest of them. Most of them had said, my name's Joe, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Art, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Mary. This guy was different. When he introduced himself, he got up and he said, howdy, my name's Floyd, and I'm a grateful hillbilly drunk. Give me a break. He started talking to me about drinking moonshine up in the mountains and about his fifth grade education. And I'm thinking, why in the hell is he telling me all this? The man don't even know who I am. I found out later he knew exactly who I was because she'd been talking about me in those meetings. People coming out and getting their car and leaving. Floyd's going down, blah, 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 blah. Remember now, I went in my own car so I can get out of here. My wife comes out, smiles, goes, bye, gets in her car and leaves. And it's me and Floyd. He talks to me about his DUI he got driving the school bus. And and getting drunk up in the mountains in the wintertime and falling down on the ground and his face freezing to the ground. And they had to pour coffee on him to get him up. Now, I'm not hearing most of this because I'm busy making a deal with God. Floyd, I don't know, talked on there for about 3-4 days. I finally got away from him, got in the car, drove home, walked in the house. My wife started to say something. I said, don't open your mouth. And she didn't. And the roller coaster ride continued down, down, down. Just when I thought the pain couldn't get worse, it got worse. Just when the loneliness couldn't be any worse, it was. The search for it, huh? I had searched for it. I thought at one time if I had enough money, that would be it. And at times in my career, I made a great deal of money, relatively speaking. And money most assuredly was not it. I thought if I had enough stuff, big enough house, big enough boat, fancy enough car, wide enough screen television. If I had all of these things, that would be it. And at various times, I had all of those things, and they were not it. I thought if I had the right woman, I knew the one I was married to wasn't the right one. If I could just have the right woman, so I would cruise the bars searching. And I would find this divine vision of loveliness sitting at the other end of a bar. And I would sit there on a bar stool planning, rehearsing in my mind what was going to be the world's greatest come-on line. And I would rehearse it over and over and over again. And I would get it down to perfection and slip off of my stool and go to the other end of the bar and sit down next to her. And she would turn and look at me, and I would look into those pools of beauty that were her beautiful blue eyes. And I would open my mouth and say to her, you want to go sit around the same thing daily? And I knew she was it because she said, yeah. Next morning, she was not it. But all of that ran out. There were no more fun bottles. There were no more good old buzzes, no good old highs. My drinking was sheer maintenance. On the afternoon of July 26, 1982, I came out of a week-long blackout drunk. Whole entire week missing. And out of the fog of that Monday evening at about twilight, I looked around myself and in my left hand was an empty bottle. I'm sitting in my old recliner chair. And in my right hand, there was a fully loaded and cocked .22 pistol. And I had not remembered picking up either one of them. And the thought that went through my head was, is this all there is? Is this truly all there is? Because if it is, you can have it. And through the fog of that evening, through the haze of that miserable hangover after a week of oblivion, there came a voice. The voice of God, not exactly. Voice of an angel, not really. It was the voice of a beautiful, wonderful, lovable, strapping, hillbilly drunk named Floyd. And the words that cut through the fog that Monday evening were simply this. I had remembered Floyd saying, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I expected God to open the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But he opened the gates of hell and let me out. And if where I was on that evening in July of 1982 was any closer to hell, I hope I never know it. And I got up out of my chair and I walked in the bathroom and I cleaned up as best I could. Gargled about a half a bottle of Listerine. Drank the rest. I got to tell you guys, for years I didn't admit that. I am a career alcoholic. And to have to stand up in front of a bunch of people and admit that my last drink was Listerine. That's disgraceful. It's embarrassing, but it's the truth. I got in my car and I drove back to the little house on the hill and pulled up behind the building and went in and sat down behind that post in the back of the room and peeked around at the front of the room. Now, I don't know about the God of your understanding, but the God you introduced me to has a sense of humor, because sitting there at the head table at the front of that room chairing that meeting was my wife. She didn't see me until the end of the meeting, when a man got up and explained those chips and said, if you want to take this white chip, surrender one day at a time. And I got up and took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life to the front of that room. And a man pressed a white poker chip into my trembling, sweating hand. And I walked back and sat down. I choose with all my heart this morning to believe that an old Bill Sanders walked to the front of that room that night and died, and that a new one walked away. Because I said at the beginning, by God's grace and your help, good sponsorship, that book and those steps, I have not taken a drink since that night. And I thank you and I thank God. You told me I needed to get a sponsor. No problem. I'm in broadcasting. I got lots of sponsors. You explained it a little more carefully, and I decided to get a sponsor scientifically. I looked around for the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired old granddaddy that I could find. One that I knew would pat me on the head every day and say, I've never seen anybody work a program as good as you. Don't change a thing. Took me about 3 weeks to find him. Finally did. He looked a lot like Mike down here. Snow-white hair. Roly-polier than I am, perpetual smile a mile wide, and I asked a man by the name of Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. I knew the first day I was in trouble. He said, sure, I'll be your sponsor. Let's talk about the rules. Rules? What rules? It's simple. You wake up every morning, you're going to roll out of that bed onto your knees, and you're going to ask God to keep you sober today. And the last thing you do before you get back in that bed at night is you're going to get on your knees again and say thank you. I said, well, now, Doc, let me tell you something. I grew up in Southern Baptist Church. When I was a kid, the church doors opened. We were there, no questions asked. I know prayer is important. God knows you open every meeting, close every meeting. But, Doc, I just got to be absolutely honest with you. I'm not comfortable with this knee business. He said, son, I didn't say a damn thing about you being comfortable. I drew myself up. By God, he couldn't talk to me like that. I had almost 30 days. I said, Doc, I've heard this is a program of suggestion. He says, it is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor. That's how we began our relationship. And then he got that book out. God knows he was a nutcase about that book. He said, don't you take this home, and I want you for the next 3 weeks to spend studying the first 164 pages of that book, not reading it, studying it. And then you come back, and we're going to talk about those things in Chapter 5 called Steps. And I said, okay, I can do that. So I stopped at the office supply place, and I got me some sharp yellow pencils, and I got me a couple of legal pads and a highlighter or two. And I went home, I cleared off my desk, and I spread it all out, and I went to work. I studied that book, and I highlighted, and I underlined, and I made notes in the margins, and I struck through the steps that didn't have anything to do with me, and I jotted down some I thought of that y'all obviously hadn't. And about 2.5 weeks later, I called him. I said, "Doc, I'm ready to talk." He said, "Hot dog, come on over here." I went over to his house. He reared back in his big old recliner chair, and I spread all my stuff out on his coffee table. He said, "All right, boy, lay it on me." I flipped the book open to chapter 5, and I reached down there, and I said, "Okay, Doc, looking here at this first step, as I interpret," and that's as far as I got. "Wait a minute, boy, that step don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing." "Yeah, but Doc, what I think it means is," he said, "son, it's in English. It says exactly what it means." He said, "If you look real close, you'll notice they put little numbers by those steps so smart college boys like you can follow along." God, he was tough. One night in a meeting, he told me, he said, "By the way, we need to get you a commitment." I said, "Okay." I spent the next 5 minutes telling him about the degrees that I held and my executive capabilities, my management skills, and my organizational skills. And he stood there watching and nodding. He said, "Got the perfect job for you." "Good." He said, "See that stack of ashtrays over there? They take them in the kitchen and wash them out good, real good, and dry them, and then bring them out and stack them in even stacks on that cabinet." God, I was incensed. My skills, and you want me washing ashtrays? 6 months later, he says, "It's time to pass that on to somebody else." I said, "No, that's my job. You can't have it." There are no little jobs. I used to go to Doc with problems. He had a lot of business acumen. And I'd go to him with problems that I was having, like a personnel problem at work. And I'd say, "Doc, I need to ask you a question. I've got this personnel problem. Let me lay out the situation." He'd say, "Bill, what step are you using on this?" I said, "Oh, no, Doc, you don't understand. This ain't got nothing to do with steps. I'm talking about real life stuff here." He'd say, "You go home and look again." And I'd go home, get the book down, and I'd go down through the steps. Wasn't anything about a personnel problem. Went back and said, "Doc, I looked, and it wasn't anything about the personnel problem. This is my situation." He said, "Go look again." About the fourth time, I'm driving home, I'm thinking, how'd I get hooked up with this crazy old bastard? But I did it. I went home and I got the book down one more time and went down there, died. There it was. There was the answer. And over and over and over again, he'd send me back to that book and back to those steps until one day the light went on in this thick skull of mine that there is nothing, nothing, absolutely nothing that is going to happen in the life of this alcoholic. The answer is in that book and in those steps. You know, some years ago, we came out with the fourth edition of the Big Book. Whoopee. Everybody was whooping and carrying on about it. Wasn't any big deal to me. Because at the time when the fourth edition came out, I was reading the 26th edition. Now, wait a minute. At that time, I had read the first 164 pages through and through 26 times. And every time I read it, they had rewritten that sucker. There was stuff in there that was not there the last time I read it. I told you I'm a highlighter and an underliner. Somebody, I don't know what this is over here, but this wasn't in here the last time I read that book. I was sharing that at a conference in California some years ago, and a little lady came up to me afterwards and said, "Do you really believe that?" I said, sweetheart, I'll tell you what I believe. I believe that God speaks to me through that book. I think he reveals himself to me through that book and shows me what I need to see when I need to see it, which behooves me to open that book and read it on a regular basis. I also believe that God speaks to me through you people. I quite often say, I pray for God's will and then go to a meeting and find out what it is. And the answers never come from who I think they've come from. I mean, my God, I thought God would at least send me a PhD, and he sent me Floyd. But you see, he knew what I needed. I never saw a burning bush talk. I never saw a voice through a trumpet or anything. I asked my sponsor one time if a burning sofa counted, and he said it didn't. I have buried three sponsors in my recovery. And between the first and the second sponsor, I have to tell you, I am not proud of my actions. Doc Crandall, my first sponsor in 1985, went on a 12-step call in November and never came home. As he and another man struggled to take a shotgun away from a suicidal young alcoholic that Doc had been trying to get sober, the struggle between the three of them, the gun accidentally discharged, somebody's hit the trigger, finger hit the trigger, we never know who. And he caught the blast in the stomach and died before he reached the hospital. He gave his life trying to save another drunk. That evening I sat in his den and I felt a loneliness come over me I hadn't felt in a long time. I felt a pain that I couldn't bear. How can I go on? How can I stay sober without the man who planted me in this program and the man who gave me these steps and who dragged me through them? How can I stay sober? And the answer came, you do it by doing what he taught you to do and what his sponsor taught him and his sponsor before him taught him all the way back to that fateful night in the spring of 1935 on May 11th when the broken-down stockbroker and the has-been doctor looked at each other in that gatehouse in Akron and said, do you think we might stay sober if we help one another? In the days and weeks and months following Doc's death, I was surrounded by the most beautiful bunch of young snot-nosed sponsees that anybody could ever have. Those little guys dragged me to meetings when I wanted to isolate. They made me share when I wanted to hide. And they loved me and they cared for me until I could walk the walk again, and I owe them forever for it. Now, I'm not proud of what I did in the next several months. The next several months, I sponsored myself. Because I was looking for another sponsor. I know today what I was looking for was a clone of Doc, which didn't exist. It took me over a year for it to soak in on me that I had a fool for a sponsor. And an even bigger fool for a sponsee. And so I picked up the phone, and I called a man that I had come to love a great deal, Dr. Paul O, and asked him if he would be my sponsor. And for the last 10 years of his life, that beautiful, wonderful little man was my sponsor, from whom I learned so much. He and his wife, Max, gave to my wife and me many pearls of wisdom that I shall cherish forever. Now, I did get to do one thing that I don't know if anybody else had got to do, and I was sharing it with somebody last night. Dr. Paul and I we emailed every day. We saw each other three or four times a year, and we talked on the phone twice a week. I always called him on usually Tuesday, and he would call me either on Thursday or Friday. One week Thursday came, he didn't call. Friday came, he didn't call, and there was no email. Saturday morning, my phone rings. Bill's Paul. Yeah, Paul, is everything okay? No, it is not. What's the matter, Paul? Max decided we need flooring in the house. All of my computer and everything is out in the middle of my study. The furniture in the living room is pushed out onto the back patio. Little Sabrina, their little dog, Shih Tzu dog, which happened to be blind, is running around the house bumping into everything because nothing's where it's supposed to be. Max, as I speak, is in the kitchen screaming at the guy who brought the wrong color tile. And I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking. And it finally, I said it. Paul maybe you need to go read page 449. Oh, that felt so good. I've been told that so many times. Jack referred to Paul the other night, and I think you don't even realize until I mentioned it after the talk that it was 13 years ago Friday, this past Friday, that Paul died of a massive aneurysm as he was checking out of the hospital. Doctors were by his side and could not save him. I did not wait a year and a half. I called Dick Martin the next day and said, would you be my sponsor? And he's been a great sponsor to me for the last 13 years. And he can cut through my bull in about an eighth of a second and doesn't hesitate to do so. I love him. I love his wife, Peggy, more. And I always am very delighted when I call and Peggy says Dick's not there and I get to talk to her for a while. She is a sweetheart. I'll share with you now what Paul Harvey used to call the rest of the story. Marriage counselors told my wife and me that the marriage was hopeless to give it up. God had other plans. In December of 1982, on the date when divorce papers were to have been finalized, my wife and I stood in front of the same minister who had married us 16 years earlier, and we renewed our vows and we started all over again. And the last 31 years have been magic. They have been wonderful. That woman today is my best friend, my lover, my soulmate, and my pal. And I'd rather be with her than anybody on the face of this earth. And she knows right now that I am in Texas talking about her and then telling you guys of how much I love her. And I know that she loves me. The little girl who wrote in her diary, I wish my daddy was dead, today, I am a good dad. Much more than I once was. But even better than that, I can tell you, I'm a damn good granddaddy. That little girl gave me two beautiful grandsons, and she even gave one of them my name. And I have a wonderful relationship with her today. She is proud of her old man. At her wedding reception, she wouldn't tell me what song she wanted to dance with me to. But when she led me out onto the dance floor and I looked into her eyes and I saw love and I saw respect and I saw all of those other traits were missing. And the music started and the words of the song were, did you ever know that you're my hero in everything I want to be? I can fly higher than an eagle. You are the wind beneath my wings. What a miracle had been worked in the lives of this family that had been ripped and shredded and torn apart by the relentless, insidious disease of alcoholism. But step by step, sponsor by sponsor, page by page, prayer by prayer, you, God, and AA had put this family back together again. And I am eternally grateful for that. My search for it, well, you know, we sit in meetings and they do the readings and we don't listen. I don't care what you say, you don't listen. You're sitting there thinking about something else. Unless they make a mistake and you go, hmm? What'd he say? One day I was listening, I don't know why, and they said, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it. And then I knew the it that I had searched for a lifetime for was right here in these rooms. You had that it all the time and was just waiting to give it to me. And all I had to do was reach out and take it. And I continue to take it. I identify myself as a recovering alcoholic. Some people say I'm a recovered alcoholic. That's fine, and I understand why. I have recovered from the hopeless state of mind and body, but I am a recovering alcoholic in that I consider myself to be a work in progress. I'm still growing. I'm still changing. I'm still learning. I am striving to remain teachable. I'm not an expert on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if anybody tells me they are, I run from them, because we're all students of that book. And I hope to remain a work in progress until the last breath I take on this earth. I love this fellowship. I love this conference. It's great to be back. I was here 23 years ago, and it's always nice to be invited back anywhere. It took you 23 years to do it, but that's okay. I want to thank Mike and John and the other Mike for their hospitality this weekend, and all of you fellows. It was great to get to know some of you, and some of you will be hearing from me, because everywhere I go, I expand my AA family. And I'll conclude by saying something that shouldn't surprise you. I'll conclude by saying, did you ever know that you're my heroes? Everything I've ever searched for and everything I've ever wanted to be. And I believe with all my heart that together, we can all soar like eagles, because he's the wind beneath our wings. God bless you, and thank you very much.